Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where we're very pleased to be devoting the next half hour to a majority world perspective on the climate emergency in the form of an interview with Ricardo Navarro from El Salvador. Navarro won the Goldman Prize for Sustainable Development back in 1995 for his work as founder and director of the El Salvador Center for Appropriate Technology, and is a former director of Friends of the Earth International. Here, he talks about how a new regional movement of climate change-affected peoples is responding to the pressures of climate change with awareness-raising, permaculture techniques and low-level technologies, as well as putting up resistance to inappropriate development. He also gives us his wider perspective on the United Nations climate talks, which he's been attending since 1992. The interview took place at the Friends of the Earth offices in Islington back in January, when Ricardo was on his way to a speaking tour in Scotland. We gave you a taster of this interview last week, but this is the first time it's been broadcast at length. The first question I asked Ricardo was about the impact that climate change was having already on his country.
In El Salvador, we are experiencing the problem of climate change. Sometimes in a slow process, sometimes in very dramatic ways. For example, when we had a Hurricane Mitch, that was in 1998, 12,000 people were killed in 3 days. Most of them were killed in Honduras, second Nicaragua, third El Salvador, and fourth Guatemala. But about 4 years ago, we had another, not hurricane, but big storm. No winds, just the rains, and just it paralyzed the whole country. Those are the dramatic ways. But also, we have things that don't look very dramatic. For example, last year, the rainy season started normally, and the government said that it's time to plant. And suddenly, when people planted, it stopped raining. And then it went without raining for several weeks. And then all the little seeds were destroyed. That doesn't make the international news because it doesn't look dramatic. But what does it mean? It means that for the country, that we have to import food from Guatemala, Nicaragua, United States, whatever. For the local people, it means that their whole survival is threatened because they plant in their season some of the crops. They eat themselves and the rest they sell to buy the other goods that they need to survive, you know, like clothing, schooling, health, whatever. And suddenly you have no money, nothing. What do you do the rest of the year? I mean, it's very dramatic for the individual, you know. Also, a couple of weeks ago, we had big winds. No rains, just big winds. I have half an acre of land around my house where I have a lot of fruit trees, you know, like avocados, mangoes and so. If you go now, you don't see the difference. I mean, it doesn't look any dramatic. But most of the little mangoes and avocados were destroyed because of the wind. The tree is there, you know, you don't see any dramatic. And I have those just for my own consumption and give it to friends, you know, because I usually have much more than what I can consume myself. But the point is that a lot of people that may depend their own lives in order to sell their agricultural produce, they get destroyed. This is like the equivalent if you have a big industry and suddenly there is a fire and, you know, 70% of the industry is destroyed. I mean, it's a big loss. And of course, a fire is always in the news because, you know, somebody comes and takes a photo and it's in the newspaper next day. But a tree that loses all the avocados is not in the news because you see the tree, it doesn't look bad, the tree, you know, some, you know, leaves are not there anymore. But all the flowers for the mangoes were flown away. And that's a big impact for the individual. So we're having a lot of impact this way. And there is another thing also. In El Salvador, the so-called development, for example, now there is a project in the area where I live where they want to build a 60-hectare golf course, you know, and they destroy all the forest to do that. Now, what do you have? Then all the water that was supposed to be underground, it doesn't get to the underground water reservoirs anymore, but it goes downhill. Last year, there were 5 people killed in that area because of the big rain, and the water increased the level of the river, and then it killed 5 people like that, including a child that was the nephew of a person that works with us. In the San Salvador, There is a river that goes through the city, and some big construction firms have been destroying forests in the upper part of the area. And the river increased the flow, and there was a big bus with 30 people inside, and the river just came to the bus and just lifted, you know, literally lifted the bus and threw it to the river. 30 people that were inside the bus were killed, plus one or two more that were walking by, and the whole bus, you know, carried them also. And those are results of destruction of our own territory, increasing the vulnerability. On one hand, we have climate change, you know, making things more complicated. And on the other hand, we are increasing our own vulnerability because of market forces, you know, demanding, you know, shopping malls or big housing complex or whatever. Like at DC, for example, a lot of tourists, you know, being developed. What does that mean? A lot of sea turtle habitats, shrimp habitats are being destroyed. And that has an impact in local population, local fishermen, for example, that they used to catch, you know, so many pounds, let's say 20 years ago. Now they don't catch perhaps 25% of that, you know, because of all the habitats are being destroyed.
How aware are people about climate change specifically and making the connections between local impacts and this wider problem of climate change?
You see, we're part of the so-called Friends of the Earth International network, and we are promoting, together with our own sister organizations from Honduras, Guatemala, Costa Rica, and others in South America, we're promoting what we call the movement of climate change affected people. And we work at three levels. First level, we work about awareness. Awareness means, on one hand, to realize what climate change is all about. You know, because occasionally somebody says that has to do with the sun cycles and has nothing to do with humans. But of course, when you come into what the IPCC, you know, is saying, or what the guys here at Tyndall or Hadley Center are talking, or, you know, NASA, Goddard Institute, I mean, all these people realize the situation is very serious. You know, we are now about 385 plus parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, and the people like Jim Hansen from NASA are claiming that has to be reduced to 350 at least. People at Tyndall are saying that if we continue the way our policies framed, we'll end up with 600 in a few decades. So the situation is very serious. But that's the scientific part of it. Now that has to be translated into social, economic, political decisions, you know, and everyday life. Because, for example, some people say, okay, let's not burn any more fossil fuels. How about if we grow fuels from land? How about biodiesel or ethanols or biochar and all that? Well, the problem is that if you do it yourself in your own house for your own needs, probably there is nothing wrong with that. But the problem is when that enters in the economy of a country, and people have to decide where they are going to grow beans or rice or fuel for cars, especially when the price of oil is very expensive, it becomes more economically attractive. So an economic decision goes for producing fuels. And then what is the problem? An impact of food prices everywhere in the world because of a switch to fuel crops. So something that scientifically may have looked fine, when it is brought into an economic system where profit-making is the main driving force, it becomes a problem, you know? So that's why we're against all these things like agrofuels, clean development mechanisms, carbon credits, all these, you know, ways you are trying to find to do the same thing. So all that is the awareness part. The other way that we work on, the other level, I should say, is resistance movements. For example, now, we have a community in El Salvador where they are building a coal power plant. We're opposing it. We just realized that another coal power plant is being built here in Kent, you know. And it's very unfortunate because some people in El Salvador say, well, you know, guys in Europe are building power plants, you know, with coal, why shouldn't we? You know, and it's very hard to say, okay, let those guys, you know, put coal power plants and we here should not. So, for example, one of the things we're planning to do is develop a solidarity between Kent and La Union, communities, NGOs, whatever, and send letters to the ambassadors from each, you know, the other people's country, and say that we are concerned because, you know, you guys are doing the same things here and there. You know what I mean? You see, in El Salvador, we have the additional problem that here in the UK, perhaps you will find a way more or less appropriate to deal with ashes. In El Salvador, the decision is going to be easier in the way that they will say, where do we put the ashes? The ashes will be put wherever it is cheaper. And where is it cheaper? Where poor people live. So the ashes will end up in somebody's community. You know what I mean? And that will generate a lot of problems for very poor people, you know, that will enter into human rights and stuff like that. We're against people who are being affected, particularly people who want their land to produce biofuels or big hydro or big roads or these golf courses I was telling you about. All this resistance movement is being built. At the same time, the other level that we work on is what we call struggle for survival. Because you see, in the climate change discussion, people talk about adaptation, you know. And as one of the guys from the Tyndall Center was saying a few months ago in The Guardian, he said, there is no way we can adapt to a 4-degree rise. The only way is let's avoid it. So we call that a struggle for survival. So what is the philosophy behind it? In the struggle for survival, we have to develop sustainability view, how we make things sustainable, how we can deepen the sense of solidarity, and how we respect sovereignty of people. We call 4S, you know, survival, sustainability, solidarity, sovereignty. You know, that's what we think is the philosophy behind it. What does that mean when it comes to a community, for example? We have to find ways to provide our own water. There has to be some wells close by. We have to protect our forests around so we keep those wells with water. At the same time, we have to disinfect the water. We have to find ways how to clean it. You know, there are a lot of so-called appropriate technologies to do that. We have to provide our own food. You know, that's another thing. We have, for example, to promote vegetarianism. You know, there was this article by WHO that showed that all the meat industry produces more CO2 than the transportation. When you go around anywhere in the world, transportation is, everywhere. I mean, when you realize that meat industry is more than that, I mean, that's almost like saying to eat meat is almost criminal. It's almost like saying that. So promoting things like vegetarianism, how to produce our own medicines, for example. I mean, there are some things, of course, we will not be able to cure, but many diseases have to do with a lot of medicinal plants around. You can combat them. How to process our own organic wastes. You know, so all these things is what we call struggle for survival. And of course, again, that has to be in a framework of solidarity. If we keep believing that profit-making should be the main driving force as it is now in the world, we are going to get nowhere.
Can I just look in detail a bit about the kind of appropriate technology side of what you touched on then?
Yeah.
Because that's how SESTA started
exactly,
off.
Exactly, as a matter of fact, exactly.
So it's got a big history of, could you say about a few of the technologies that, yes, that you're finding useful?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, we were found in 1980 when the movement of appropriate technology was something, new and seemed like interesting, and our name is that, Salvadorian Center for Appropriate Technology. That's the name of our institution.
Come out of those kind of Schumacher.
Exactly, thing. Exactly. It was kind of Schumacher, you know. There was the big center here in the UK, and every European country had a European. I was working 1 year at SCOT, the Swiss Center for Appropriate Technology. You know, there was this big center also in the Netherlands. So it was that kind of idea. You know, Schumacher probably brought the philosophical push into that. And then there are successors here in the UK. Anyway, we started promoting things like bicycles, for example, bicycle use, out of that. And it has become very difficult because still in our countries, believe it or not, it is easier sometimes to promote bicycle use in countries like the UK, because in our countries, cars are seen more as a status symbol, more than here, you know what I mean? And then it's harder to push bicycles, and bicycles are related with non-development kind of thing. And now, of course, when oil prices go up, bicycles may be seen, but we are still in that debate. The politicians in our countries are not smart, as a matter of fact, particularly the right wings. They are very stupid, I should say. I don't know what other word, nicer word to use, but that's the truth. At the same time, of course, related to bicycles, we promote also wheelchairs, because there are a lot of handicapped people in El Salvador. Also, we have done a lot of work in things like dry composting latrines, because it's a way of handling properly human wastes and not polluting the water. That's very, very important. We are also working a lot of in agroecology, how to produce organic farming, how to process our own organic wastes, compost them, you know, programs of reforestation, you know, tree planting. Because you see, a lot of times, because of food needs, people may destroy a forest and go beans or rice or corn, you know, and the trees are very important, you know. So we have to find a way for the climate. We have to find a way how to produce our own food, try not to use or depend on pesticides and keep the trees. I mean, this is what we call agroecology.
And you also had a big interest in permaculture. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Permaculture is one of the things that, you know, Mr. Bill Mollison in Australia, and we have had people from Australia working with us.
Maybe we can have a look again at the opposition to the coal-fired power stations.
Yeah.
Because I understand there was a march as well with about how many thousands of people?
Oh, yes, we have had about 8,000 people marches.
And one of the main demands of the march was an end to
as a matter of fact, power stations. That was the main demand. We took advantage of the march and protested for other things too. But the main demand was not to have the coal and natural gas power plants. And it was very interesting because we managed to gather so many people that the two mayor candidates for the municipal government, both of them, left and right, said they disagree with the coal power plants. You know, of course, you can always claim that the right is just, you know, opportunistic. And so it's probably true. But the thing is that both of them said, and of course, the left won. And the left mayor now, he was one of the main organizers of the march. So we're very happy with him. We already talked with him. And to, you know, on
how long ago was the election?
The election was on January 18th.
Okay.
Yeah, so just a few weeks ago.
This is in San Salvador?
No, La Unión. This is the eastern part of the country. And this guy that's now the mayor, 12 years ago, we organized another march with him. We organized it because we had two offers. One of them is that they were going to bring 400 tons of tires and burn them there to generate electricity.
From New Orleans.
From New Orleans. And the other proposal was they are going to bring millions of tons of ashes from Virginia and develop 400 hectares something at the coast, you know, like the guys from Netherlands do, you know, recover land from the coast.
Okay.
And they were going to build 400 houses for poor people, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So we had big demonstrations in those days, 12 years ago, and we managed to stop those projects, you know. So we're very excited now that the mayor there is in our side.
But you have some confidence that the coal-fired power station will not go ahead?
You see, the problem is that they already got the permits with the right, with the actual government, and the actual central and municipal government. And for example, the natural gas power plant, they bought 40 hectares of land. They destroyed the forest for a hectare, and they're, you know, going fast. They're running fast to build the thing. And I have to tell you that last year, when they destroyed the forest, all the some of the trees that they destroyed came down with the river and they clogged the passage of water under a bridge, and they had an overflow and they generated a lot of trouble, you know. And the coal power plant, the same. They got the permit a little later, but they are running fast in order to build as much as they can before the new government comes. So when the new government comes, we're going to have that problem, because the other guys are going to say, well, we already built it. We already spent a lot of money. And if you want to stop it, you have to compensate. And it's going to be more difficult. But so we still don't know what... Yeah, exactly.
So you've had a lot of successes over the years in these kind of ongoing kind of
yeah,
battles.
Successes,
kind of
failures,
corporate development, you know. Corporate-led development, really, isn't it?
Yeah. We, in El Salvador, corporates have a, a much higher percentage of control than they do in the United States or the UK or places like that. You know, in our country, it's blatant.
I was reading an assessment, I can't remember whose assessment it was, of El Salvador, basically saying, okay, there was a civil war and then 1992 peace agreements, but really there's been a neoliberal agenda ever since.
Exactly.
So pretty much
exactly. The right-wing politicians in El Salvador are honestly probably the worst breed of politicians anywhere in the world. You know, that's called the ARENA party. Just to remind you, ARENA, the leading right-wing party, it was founded by the guy who ordered the Archbishop Romero's killing. You know, I mean, that's how things start. So it's very hard to find good things from them.
Going back to the Civil War, I know one of your projects was a forest of reconciliation.
Exactly.
Planting 65,000 trees, one for every person that died.
Exactly. The idea was to plant 75,000 trees. We did that some time ago. To have a tree for every person who was killed during the battle.
And again, they're productive trees, useful trees, fruit and medicinal.
Yeah, it's trees that people can use for medicinal purpose on some fruit trees, you know. So you just need to be able to adapt to that situation.
I'm just wondering if there's enough talk about appropriate technology at things like the UN talks. I mean, the whole thing seems very much corporate-led, and it's all about big corporate energy projects, or even actually with the CDM, it's you're getting money going to polluting corporations a lot of the time, just kind of boosting their profits, and they're not really doing anything useful for the local community.
Exactly.
Do you think the appropriate technology should play a part in those discussions?
Yeah, people have to realize that we have to develop a new development paradigm. We cannot continue doing the same things. We have to find a way to go carbon zero economy as soon as possible, if we want to survive. That's the thing. And in the United Nations, the talk is how we can keep doing the same things, basically. They don't say it like those words, but that's what the force behind is. This last May 3rd, if I remember, 2008, there was a big tropical cyclone in Burma. 146,000 people were killed at the event. Now, the figure is close to 1 million. But when you look at 146,000 people killed in one climate event, that's just as much as people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. And you want to keep doing the same things? That is criminal. We have to find new ways. And technology can certainly play a very important role. For example, how to process our own waste, how to produce our own medicine. And that was called appropriate technology. After Schumacher's book, you know, Small is Beautiful, I do believe that kind of technology has to be, you know, implemented worldwide. For example, one of the things I believe is that every citizen in the world should have a bicycle. You know, simple as that, you know. And that is how much that costs. I'm sure that costs much less than one of the nuclear submarines that you guys want to, you know, build here.
Trident.
Exactly. You know.
I mean, to what extent is kind of SESTA or Friends of the Earth El Salvador discussing what you feel it would be the ideal response to come out of Copenhagen? Maybe my first question should be, how well do you think the interests of the Latin American people are represented at the United Nations?
Yeah, usually politicians don't represent people. Usually politicians represent economic forces. That's the main thing we have to understand. My idea about the Copenhagen talks is to find a way how we can make our voice being heard, because the discussions are not in the proper way. We have to realize that our present political economic system is leading us into a suicidal path. Sooner or later, we are going to realize it when it is too late. That's the problem. To me, the discussions in Copenhagen is like if you have a discussion among drunkards, you know? They have a lot of people that have consumed a lot of alcohol, and they know that the liver is getting destroyed with alcohol. More or less, they heard a doctor talking like that, and they are discussing, and one guy says, okay, we're going to switch from vodka to rum, you know? Another guy comes and says, yes, but after every time we have a drink of rum, you drink a glass of milk. You know what I mean? I mean, anybody comes and says, you guys stop drinking, period. Stop drinking, period. You know? And I am using that example because, as a matter of fact, I met a person who was in that situation, and the doctor told him, if you want to survive, you have to stop drinking. And the guy said, I'll stop drinking. And he never drank anymore. The doctor said, you may live a couple more years, and he lived about 4 years. And that's the kind of decision we had to take. We have to stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere, period. But what happens? That governments, pushed by big corporation interests, they don't want to stop flying planes. They want to continue building coal. They want to continue building oil, natural gas. I believe that the United Nations should be discussing that the main imperative force is that we have to live within the constraints of the environment, for the simple reason that if we go out of there, we're going to destroy ourselves. To me, it's very simple. If you have a little donkey, and the donkey can carry 200 pounds, you know, you cannot put more than 200 pounds. If you put 500 pounds, you're going to kill the donkey. You know, what's the difference between the donkey and the atmosphere? It's just a matter of size. And big means you just have to find the number, and that number should not be exceeded. And that requires what I might call a political, ecological system, that the main driving force should be the wisdom, environmental wisdom, that we have limits and we have processes. Those should be the main driving forces in our political system. But now the main driving forces are economic. And what economic forces demand is economic profit. And if they keep economic thinking, there is no way out for our survival.
It's difficult, though, isn't it, to change the economic system through the UN talks.
Exactly.
But you could at least impose a cap that was scientific and then find some way of distributing it. And then,
exactly.
And that would inform the way the economy develops in the future.
Yeah. In our part of the world, we're suffering the consequences of overconsumption. That the climate change is generated by an excessive amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which is the result of excessive levels of consumption. And the problem is that the people who are suffering the consequences are people who have not consumed, people who are vulnerable. You know, this is a very funny thing. It's like the rich people generated the problem and poor people are paying the consequence. This is like, rich people go to a nice restaurant and have a very good meal, you know, with a lot of champagne and wine and all the good stuff. And suddenly there is a poor guy going by and they say, you poor guy have to pay the bill. And he didn't even taste the food. Can you believe it? This is injustice. And this is what is happening with climate change. And we have to understand that we have to find a new way of living where we can survive as a species, because this climate change problem is taking us into a suicidal path. Eventually, all of us are going to lose. Because here in Europe, for example, you may not have big hurricanes, but you may have big heat waves. And only God knows what's going to happen, you know. In Finland, for example, they are saying, oh, we're going to have, Mediterranean climate in the future. Mediterranean climate with tropical insects. And tropical insects are going to generate a lot of health problems in Finland, because we in El Salvador, we are more or less used to mosquitoes, more or less. When mosquitoes come and they bite the Finnish people, they are not, that's going to be painful. And beetles and things like that are going to destroy their forests. So what does that mean? Everyone is going to suffer. It's like in the Titanic, when the first people who drown, the people who are in the lower parts, but eventually the people who are in the upper floors are also going to suffer the consequence. So I think it's in the interest of everybody to try to promote more justice. And this is an important issue, that the solution to climate change, it goes through a justice movement. This is very important.